away, but now you've returned, oh son of mine, 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 son of mine. Took you away, but now you've returned, oh son of mine, oh son of
Wanda Six, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are listening to Avery Sharp's Son of Mine from his Sojourner Truth album, Ain't I a Woman. And I thought this was kind of apropos, Oh Son of Mine. She's singing about the son who was sold away from her. In slavery, you know, Sojourner Truth is well known for that piece, Ain't I a Woman? Want to welcome to the studio Robert Hillary King to talk to us about solitary confinement, what's going on with Angola 3, Albert Woodfox specifically, and his recent tour, which brought him through the San Francisco Bay Area. In connection with Amnesty International and a hearing at the California State Health and Human Services Committee chaired by Representative Amiano out of San Francisco to talk about the human rights abuses of solitary confinement. Good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning, Wanda. How are you? I'm okay.
I'm good. Perhaps you can maybe talk first about the campaign that was launched yesterday internationally by Amnesty, where you were in conversation with Tini about Tini Miller, about her her husband's killing, which was attributed to was it attributed to all three of you, and then they realized
no.
that it was withhold, or just
it, well, you know, you were clustered up as Angola 3, Wanda, you know, and so everybody feeling, I think that, which is a good opportunity to not explain it, everybody feels that we were charged in the same crime, but we weren't. I was not charged in the Miller's murder, simply put. But they had me under investigation for that, even though I was 150 miles away. I wasn't in prison, but I was under investigation for that for the entire 29 years I was in solitary confinement. So that's the difference in that. But Herman and Albert, as you know, were charged along with two others in the Miller, Brent Miller murder, and they were subsequently convicted. One was acquitted. And we know the details of a Herman, his itinerary through and journey through prison hell, and all the results of it and the culmination of it. But presently, you asked about Abbott and how is he doing, and you asked about the campaign that, you know, since that time and so forth and so on. So I'll kind of catch you up to that bit. And what Amnesty launched out yesterday, actually, I was aware of it. I actually, you know, sent the letter in. I haven't read the newsletter yet, but I was I saw a glimpse of it, where Amnesty is again pushing for the release of Albert Woodfox out of prison. And we're asking people, you know, to go to our website and sign a petition. And yes, I did. There was some additional evidence. And, you know, if anybody had any doubts about this case being a miscarriage of justice, the widow for years did not have any doubt that it was a miscarriage of justice. And she thought about it and thought about it. And finally, she has again, as in the first episode of, you know, in the Land of the Free, the initial episode, she pointed out, you know, that she felt that Herman and Albert were innocent, that they were living a nightmare. And she enhanced that statement recently, you know, and over the years, that she actually totally believed that. And what made it much more apparent is that I was charged in a relatively linked to it. The death of a husband, a man whom I had never met, and I had been treated thus, you know, and she learned a little bit incrementally about the case, and she learned better, and over the years she had a change of heart, and the more she thinks about it, and the more the state treat her with the disdain that she feels the state has treated her with, because she was a bride of 16, not even 17 at the time, when all of this occurred. And the state did not, even though they had people on the investigation, they had locked people up, convicted people, but she did not get compensated at all for the wrongful death of a husband. So she, and with all of this, you know, flying around, all of these things evolve over the years, she is convinced that Herman and Albert and other people involved in it, and even those relatively who, myself included, you know, were victims, and she is speaking out, and which is good. It's a good thing to do. She believed that there has been a miscarriage of justice in this case. Hopefully, this will have an impact. Like I say, we don't need any more, much more, but. You know, not disregarding every pebble in the pond count, but I'm saying is that we have created mounds of insurmountable evidence that this case is a miscarriage of justice, and we're just hoping is that the three-judge panel in deciding again for the third time this case, that they do not send it back in the hands of Buddy Caldwell. I won't say the state of Louisiana, because there are some beautiful people in the state of Louisiana. We have good supporters in the state of Louisiana. It is Buddy Caldwell, and, you know, and his cry for vengeance for whatever reason to make sure this lie stands out, make sure careers are not clouded by suspicion of, you know, prosecutorial misconduct and all the rest of the stuff that goes with it. So, but we are hoping this, and this is where we are. This is where we are now, and of course, the campaign has always been, you know, even though Herman Abbott and I, you know, our focus, that was the main focus, to get out of prison, but it was our sole intent to join a much bigger, a broader movement, and, you know, and to have some impact, and this is what I hope these journeys, these itineraries that you mentioned I'm taking can contribute to this, and so this is what I do. This is what I do now. Is of course, Albert is the primary focus now, and so are many other prisoners. are the primary focus. But we're raising the bar again for everyone. We're hoping that the thing that we are doing now can be impactful throughout the nation, that can have, you know, and I think we're doing it without even, some of us, without even realizing it, that there is a collective effort, you know, ashore, and all of these pebbles, the coalition, the waters are coming, and, you know, I think we're making some headway, and I think we just have to keep doing what we are doing, and I think we will not only impact or have an impact on Albert being freed, ultimately being freed, but others as well. And this is the quest. This is what we're trying to do, and that is myself propelled and self-enhanced mission. You know, I think I owe it to myself to do no less. I mean, to have underwent that type of experience for those years, and then to come out and live a sedentary lifestyle and just go into seclusion, it just wouldn't have made sense to me. So I love what I'm doing, and I guess I'll continue. Okay, I've said a lot.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could clarify for our listening audience who might not be aware of who Buddy Caldwell is and why he is so intent on challenging all of the, judicial rulings that say, okay, you should free, you know, Albert Woodfox, or you should free Herman Wallace. You know, Herman Wallace was actually freed from prison only to, you know, die about 3 days later. So Albert is the sole person left, you know, under that, you know, sort of name, the Angola Three, but you always talk about how, you know, there's more than just Angola Three. Is Angola Nine, the Angola Seven, the Angola, you know, innumerable number of people. So if you could talk about, you know, just sort of, well, tell us who Buddy Caldwell is, and then perhaps talk about the effect of solitary and confinement, not just on the person, but on you know, family. Because I was playing, you know, that song about, you know, Sojourner Truth lamenting the loss of her son, and you make the parallels between imprisonment and slavery, and other people have also made those particular parallels, and you think about sort of the loss to family and to society of so many men and women, you know, to the prison system. Prison industrial complex. So first, Buddy Caldwell, and then
yes,
talk
Buddy
about
Caldwell. Yes, Buddy Caldwell. He's Attorney General of the state of Louisiana, and he came up through the rank. He just happened to be the boyhood friend of John Sinkfield, a young attorney at the time, who methodically broken every constitutional law to convict Albert Woodfox. All is really with prosecutorial misconduct and misstatement by he and another senior attorney at the time named John Piku. Anyway, John Sinkfield used the case. He came up through the rank. He prosecuted that case, Albert's case, you know, and related, you know, fact that he was a member of the Black Panther Party, even during that early trial. Subsequently, some 20 years later, Albert's case was overturned. By this time, John Sinkfield, along with his boyhood friend, Buddy Caldwell, whom they started in the second grade together, he also came up through the ranks and became an assistant attorney, and then he worked under John Sinkfield. And during the time in which Albert's conviction was first overturned, John Sinkfield just happened to be the attorney at the time. For some reason, it should have went back to the district court, but it didn't, and it was sent to the state's attorney general office, which is sort of unusual. But to kind of bring you up to par a little bit, all the details are not necessary. Just a connection that John Sinkfield had with Buddy Caldwell. Buddy Caldwell has become, as a result of John Sinkfield no longer being the Attorney General, Buddy Caldwell became the Attorney General. He was involved during the second trial. There was another assistant attorney named Judy Caldwell, who during Caldwell, she worked with Buddy Caldwell. She worked with John Sinkfield in the Attorney General office. She alleged she was the one put it out there that Black Panther give a new trial and he would be tried as a Black Panther. And this is what she did. She put the Black Panthers on trial in the case of Albert Woodfox. And Albert Woodfox was subsequently found guilty again out of a parish that the case should not have been. But when it got overturned, his case got overturned again, it was also taken over by the Attorney General office, in which Judy and Buddy Caldwell was a part of. But this time, Buddy Caldwell was a state's Attorney General. So careers and validations of careers up through the ranks have been made, you know, and the attorneys use these, you know, these misdeeds that has been done, the misjustice that's been done, you know, as a way of validating their own careers. Again, Buddy Caldwell and John Sinkfield were childhood friends. They went to law school together. They worked together. They're in cahoots together with prosecutorial misconduct of cases. Buddy Caldwell and Julie Cullen, their history of their having an intimate relationship that they are lawyers and nobody else don't want to talk about. You know, but these are things that prisoners in prison, you get these things because they have the same attorneys. I've met guys who knew Judy Cullen before she even got on the case and knew she was hooked up with attorneys, you know, who prosecuted other cases, that she was lovers while defending one client. She was lovers to, you know, to a prosecutor. I mean, how much further can you go? But these are things that have never been validated. They have never been, you know, talked about because they push them under the barrel. But these are the type of people we are dealing with. And this is the reason why, and I don't see the state of Louisiana, but I see certain segments who represents the state of Louisiana, who have the power and abuse this power in misrepresenting the state of Louisiana in the name of the people, you know, they are the ones who are perpetuating this farce. They're keeping it going. And so this is what we're doing. We're trying to, like I say, you know, we will continue to keep it, keep our effort up in uncovering in whatever way we can, you know, ways and means and the truth, you know. And like I said, we have this on our side now. We have the truth on our side, and we'll, you know, continue to do this. But with regards to solitary confinement and the impact that it have on people and, you know, on individuals and their families, I imagine, you know, like I talk about my experience, and it's easier to, you know, to talk about it. I don't have a problem. I don't think I'm not traumatized by it, but I'm also not misguided. I don't have the misguided concept or the belief that I wasn't impacted by solitary confinement. I mean, it gravely impacted me, and I can feel it. If not physically, I can feel it, you know, the psychological impact that it has had upon me, you know, and how it had caught, you know, even though I denied this, or maybe I couldn't see it at the time, but you know, being out here has shown me just how negatively impact a person can be in with solitary confinement, even if it's not apparent. And like I recently, you know, pointed out at the Association of Scientists in Chicago recently about. It's sort of embarrassing, you know. I think about it. I used to get lost and get confused, you know, being right around the corner, and that happens sometime now. And I imagine all of this come about as being acclimated, you know, to closed cell, you know, restrictions like that. And this was validated by a lady scientist whom I never met. She was a neurologist. I can't think of her name, but her finding shows that the brain actually shrinks, you know. And I've always felt that. I couldn't think of another term, but she pointed out, and she used that term in another term, that it, because you're held in closed cell restriction and for all these many months, these years, and it impacts you. So, yeah, solitary confinement impacts you, but I imagine there's a great impact across the board because the family of prisoners held in solitary confinement are impacted. They have to go through loops of and hoops of fire in order just to get to see their loved ones. Many of them can't even travel the distance that they're keeping it, you know, the prisoners away, you know, from family. So it impacts, and if you're in solitary confinement, you suffer a greater loss of companionship. I mean, you if you're in a regular, you know, dormitory or something like that, you may come in contact and have some, you know, contact with your family every now and then, you know, to keep that tie going. But if you are restricted, you know, behind screen, to have to talk through mics and so forth, all this is dehumanizing. This is, and it's sort of crazy. Looking at it now through any lens, you know, it seems unholy. It's wicked. I mean, for the, you know, the people have to, regardless of what happened, that they'll have to succumb to these type of things. And family also have to, you know, become, you know, our enemy for some reason. The state see the family as enemy as well as the prisoner. And, of course, and, you know, you can't help but link all of this and see the parallels of slavery without a doubt. You know, and prison, you know, I mean, the language, I mean, just with right in your face language let you know that slavery really wasn't abolished where prisons are concerned. So all they had to do now and what they have been doing over the centuries was legitimize prison. And when they legitimize prison, you legitimize a slavery again, because if you say prisons are humanized, then slavery is also humanized, because you know, slavery allows you to, you know, you to experience imprisonment, and you become a slave of the state. So yeah, and is that an immoral in it? Of course. I think this is why I always say our battle, you know, has to be fought morally. Legally, we'll lose unless we're able to change the laws. And by that time, if we try to change the law, or if the law changes itself or evolve itself, you know, then the person, you know, the person don't outlive that that time. People are dying as a result of waiting for the law to be changed. I think we have to just raise the bar a bit for everyone, bring it back to the level of showing that prison is, in fact, a form of slavery, just an extenuation of slavery. And I use the language. And I think we are making some impact, because we now have people everywhere looking at solitary confinement. We have people doing a lot of things. I mean, even main media are talking about imprisonment. They're talking about changing or restructuring the quote, the justice system. I think we have to it result as what we are doing collectively on a whole, and I think we should continue to do this. But yes, in the meantime, all of this is impactful on the lives, you know, in the health of the prisoner, in the health of the family and the loved one who goes to see him, who has to go to see them. They're depriving themselves of things that they could be doing. I mean, it's not it's a deprivation that is self imposed, because you love your loved one, but at the same time, it's unnecessary, and it's imposed by the state. It's perpetuated by the state, initiated by the state, you know. And so these are things that these are the broader focus. These are the things that we are faced with, but these are the things that we are accomplishing, because we are making noise and people are listening, and we have to keep making the noise, Wanda.
Mhm. Yeah. A lot of long, you know, people have been held a long time for their political beliefs are getting released, or coming out of solitary confinement. Hugo Pinnell, after what, 40 years, he had his first contact visit with his mother, yeah, or more, about what, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and then I saw that Black Panther member finally, after gosh, a long time incarcerated, he was released. I can get the name a little bit, and I wanted to give people Albert Woodfox's information if they want to write him. And Albert, the prison number is 72148, and he's at David Wade Correctional Center, N1A3. And then the address is 670 Bell Hill Road, Homer, Louisiana, 71040. And I was just checking to see if Leonard Peltier had been one of the people released, but he hasn't been released. And Leonard Peltier is at USP Coleman 1, and his prison number is 89637-132. And the address there is P.O. Box 1033, Coleman, Florida, 32521.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those are correct, Albert's address. And the brother is just trying to think of, Jess, I got the word that Marsha Conway was released after 40 years, which is good. It goes back to what you were saying about maybe, you know, the waves and the stuff that's about solitary and about everything else. I mean, justice is sort of like the people, you know, have seen, gotten behind the idea that there's something wrong, and I think they want to try to, public knowledge and public dissent means a lot. Public sentiment can really, you know, public legal opinion counts greatly, especially in the concept of legality and legal prisons and you know, in the legal courtrooms. I think that is what's happening. So yeah, Conway, I had saw Nzunga, she was at the, his wife was at the Black Panther party reunion in New Orleans not long ago, in October, I believe. And yeah, and she had mentioned something similar to that. But I'm sure that this is he's getting out is a good shot in the arm for the movement. It is really great. I'll always say justice delayed is justice denied. The fact is just that, you know, you could maybe turn that lemon into lemonade, just make it work. I look at it as being part of evolution. It's kind of hard to do while you're doing it, but once you get past it, after a while, it mellows out. So hopefully this brother, I'm glad that he was able to get out, and I'm sure his transition and will be great. He has no problem. He's surrounded by a great team of people whom I know, and I'm sure that they will give him the love and whatever else he need in order to make the right and the proper transition. And then he himself being able to withstand that for 40 years and being there. And I've talked to him, the last time I spoke to him was about two years or so ago. He's strong with a strong mind, and he always maintained his innocence, and that's what I always tell Blood to do, you know. A lot of people were framed during that time. They wanted to frame anybody, and it didn't make any difference whether you did it or not. But he maintained that. And so it aided him in the final analysis and the people behind him who believed in him. But I just wanted to say that a little bit before I sign off, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also I wanted to mention that Russell Maroon Schultz, he also is no longer in solitary. He was released into general population recently as well, last month. And I don't know how long he had been in solitary. Oh, yeah, for 30 years.
30 years. Those are just the one we know. There are others that we don't know that I read about that has been released, you know. They have been doing this and all of this, like I say, it's coming. You know, it's happening, and the fact that it's happening mean that, you know, we're making some form of progress.
Right, yeah, and if people want to write Russell Schultz, he writes back. His prison number is AF3855-SCI-4GRATERFORD, P.O. Box 246, Route 29, Greater Ford, Pennsylvania, 19426-0246. And you can also visit his website, russellmaroonschultz.wordpress.com. While we wait for Angela Bell to join us, I was wondering if you could talk about, there's a couple of things, California, folks at Pelican Bay, the men, and then there were simultaneous sympathetic hunger strikes to protest the inhuman solitary confinement in the SHU, or what is it, SHU, what does SHU stand for?
Housing unit. It's a security housing unit.
Right, it's right.
A,
and you were held in something like that. Yeah, they called it something different at in Angola, but you were held in something like that. But this whole idea of, you know, of sensory deprivation. And I wanted you to talk about, oh, there's Angie, talk about you know, you were targeted as a kid. It was just crazy the way they, I mean, you just kept on, and, you know, you talk about that and From the Bottom of the Heap, you know, your memoir, which is in its second edition and second printing now. People can get it. Can they get it from your website or from PM Press website?
PM Press is the one to do it.
Okay.
PM Press is the one to go. They could go online and read it.
Yeah. Oh, they can read online too? Oh, okay.
Oh, well, yeah, that's what the lawyers did. They went online and got, they wanted some information and they went online and got it. So,
okay. Why don't you talk, before we bring Angie into the conversation and talk about her recent paper that she just published on solitary confinement using your case as one of the examples. If you talk about the criminalization of youth, because, you know, that's not something that's recent. People might just be hearing about it, but, you know, for black and brown youth specifically, you know, going back to, you know, what, how many years now? If they're doing it in the 50s and it's 2014 now.
That's a lot
of years of targeting and criminalizing young people.
Well,
and it's throwing them away into the prisons, trying them as adults and throwing them away for extended, you know, lengths of time, you know, sometimes almost life, you know, because you spent several lifetimes behind bars. You could talk about the criminalization.
Well,
and
briefly,
what happened
to say
you.
Some time. Yes, like you say, you know, it was really during the 40s. I think in New Orleans, they called Milliner Boys Home was Louis Armstrong speak of Milliner Boys Home. Just so you know how old Louis Armstrong was. So it goes back, way back. However, you know, there were many laws that, you know, that were unwritten laws that allowed them to send teenagers or send kids to prison at 14 and 15 years old. Of course, these laws became probably valid because they were challenged, and they became, you know, laws that written into the Constitution that you could place, depending on certain crime, a kid into a certain environment. But like you say, I mean, in an adult environment, you know, depending on the crime, the nature of the crime and so forth, which is, but that is something, like you say, the parallel there. I mean, way back then, I look what happened to the Scottsboro Boys way back then, these young kids that went, I mean, that were kids. I mean, plucked from, we never had any schooling at all and was sent to prison, and many of them died in prison, and it was years before it was really exonerated. So the parallels have been there, especially for blacks or youth. The fact that I went through it wasn't anything unusual. It wasn't unique in my case at all. The fact that I written about it and, you know, spoke about it, and my case probably had become known more than others, but there were so many others prior to me and before me and after me, even now, that hasn't been written. So people are, you know, the laws are there to place juveniles. It has always been there to place juveniles into prison, you know, prime them for prison or to send them from juvenile detention. Because when I went to Scotlandville, there were many times if you committed what they call, and these were unwritten laws, if you committed a crime while in Scotlandville, they call it State Industrial School for Colored Youth, by the way, during that time. But if you violated, they sent you to a place called De Quincy, which they call a young penitentiary. I mean, 17 and 18. But they had people who were in De Quincy. They had a young youth prison in Louisiana long before they were fashionable, you know, elsewhere. And then when you left De Quincy, if you left from De Quincy, if you did something in De Quincy, they sent you straight to Louisiana State Prison. And so you were sent from a kid to an adult prison. So the parallels have been there. The practice has been there for some time, Amanda. So, yes, and they continues. And I think until and unless, you know, we take the reins and take control, and I think the thing that we're doing collectively, we're getting attention, and we're doing this. I think, but unless and until we continue and do it, these type of things will continue. We'll continue to see the parallels.
So we're speaking to Robert Hillary King about Angola 3. He's bringing us up to date on what's going on with the case, specifically around Albert Woodfox and the recent campaign that was launched by Amnesty International that you can read about. Actually, it was launched yesterday, Tuesday, which was also Fat Tuesday or Mardi Gras, and today is the first day of Lent for those who think about sort of the whole idea of sort of that introspection that happens during this, I don't know, is it 40 days? No, not 40 days. You know,
leading up to
the resurrection day, yeah. we're joined by your good friend, Robert, Professor Angela A. Allen Bell, Assistant Professor of Legal Analysis and Writing at Southern University Law Center. She's got a new piece that she just published last month, Reassessing Solitary Confinement 2, the Human Rights, Fiscal, and Public Safety Consequences. And she's referencing hearing before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sorry for cutting y'all, but I didn't know I would be on with Professor Bell, but since I am with her, just holler at her. But I want you to know that I still have 100 boxes of cane. I'm sealing up. I'm traveling in the next few days, and I need to go. I do have to go. If you had prepared me for this, I would have been here to listen to Angie. But send me a copy of it, and I would love to listen to it. But I got people waiting on me, and I have to see a can dip. I'm sorry. But anyway, okay. Give Angie my regards,
well,
my love,
right
and
there.
Tell
you,
her
you can tell.
Hello,
can
Angie. How you doing?
Yeah, good morning. Hi.
Good morning.
I can't hear you.
Yeah, cool. I had no idea that we would be on. I thought we had different segments, and I wasn't looking for it, so I booked myself to do some other things later. But I'll catch
no
that.
Problem. No problem.
Yeah. All right,
that's
let me
okay.
go. And and it's good talking to you again, Wanda, and it's good to hear your voice, Angie. And
same
I'm looking
here,
forward to,
and have a good
yeah.
day.
Good day. Okay, you
all
too.
Right.
Take care. Okay, bye.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye, Wanda.
Bye, thank you. Good morning, Professor Bell. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing just great. Just great. No Mardi Gras here. It was wet, cold, nasty, and so it was another day of work for me and for my law students who have an assignment due this morning. So all is well on this end, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sending me this this wonderful and quite well-documented, research here around solitary confinement, and you name it Reassessing Solitary Confinement 2, so there must be a 1.
Yes, that is correct. What this statement was written in preparation for was a hearing that is chaired by Senator Dick Durbin. Now, it is called 2 because it is a sequel hearing. The initial hearing was held in 2012, and the first hearing was called by Senator Dick Durbin, and it was called Reassessing Solitary Confinement 1. And it was the first time in this country that we have had a hearing like this where we have people from all of the respective places involving solitary, like representatives of the penal institutions, victims who have suffered through this system that is riddled with flaws. We have people, representing the correctional aspects, people representing the medical aspects, and then, of course, academics talking about some of the legal aspects of this. And so what these hearings did was solicited statements from people all across the country who have studied the issue in some capacity or another. And the first hearing, not only did it expose so many aspects of solitary confinement that people don't know, but it also prompted a lot of states to really be honest about what they are doing and to reevaluate and reassess some of their practices and policies. And what came out of the first hearing back in 2012 was a lot of states did some things that are extremely meaningful. The federal government did something very meaningful in that many of them assessed, studied, looked into policy changes, and that prompted, of course, this follow-up hearing to see where we are and what still needs to be done. And so the statement that you have is my contribution, but this is one of many. There are people from all over the country who have written statements to educate the senators about issues relative to prolonged solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so why don't you go over some of the sort of the findings specifically around sort of where we are right now and sort of where we need to go in your assessment of, you know, the time from the first hearing to the present reassessment or
Sure. Looking
at what happened.
The 2012 hearing did something very basic, and that was just to educate states and the public about the fact that solitary confinement is not what most people would have considered it to be. I think most people thought when you hear solitary confinement that it is a place that you may put somebody who simply will not follow rules. And what the first hearing exposed was that solitary confinement is so much more than that, and it is often abused because it is not just a place for people who have done something wrong, but oftentimes it's a place for people who have done absolutely nothing wrong. And so at the first hearing, we learned that many members of vulnerable populations are being subject to solitary confinement unnecessarily. For example, women who have complained in prison that they may have been raped or sexually harassed, as opposed to the prison addressing the merits of the complaint, the response has often been to just send the woman to solitary. Members of the LGBT community, members who may not be active in gangs but may have formerly been a part of gangs, who have arrived at the prison maybe with some type of gang tattoo that is dated, and there's no real basis for putting them in solitary. Members of the mentally ill population, the first hearing showed us that prisons are not just using this as a disciplinary tool, but prisons are using this very, very arbitrarily and oftentimes when not necessary. The first hearing also showed us that when people are put in solitary for any number of reasons, many of which are frivolous, there is no procedure legally in place for that particular inmate to advocate for their release. And so there is some defects where due process is concerned because the inmate is entitled to a hearing. How often the hearing happened is going to be different in every jurisdiction, but what is uniform across the country is that there is an entitlement to a hearing at some point. The problem is that there's no burdens of proof required. There is no evidentiary requirement on the part of the prison. The standard is so low, it only requires the prison to produce some reason, and that could be anything, to keep them there. And so that was exposed at the first hearing. The first hearing well documented the fact that when you put a person in solitary confinement for an extended period of time, it is going to be some type of psychological injury to result. The first hearing exposed that it costs more to house someone in solitary confinement for a prolonged period. And, of course, the first hearing taught us that it is bad practice to take somebody immediately out of solitary and then release them onto the public. And so that first hearing exposed many things, but offered very little in the way of solutions. And so when that hearing ended, a lot of states, for example, California, held hearings to explore how they are, in fact, using solitary and to visit the question of whether changes need to be made. Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Maine, Mississippi, there are many other states, but these are just some illustrations of states that said, we're doing this too much. We're doing this unnecessarily, and we need to figure out a game plan to do it less, to perhaps abolish it. And so what came out of that first hearing is some models of how we could either reduce solitary populations or put systems in place so that people can gradually earn their way out. So the second hearing, I think, expanded the conversation from a national one to an international one, because after the first hearing, we got an official statement from Juan Mendez, the special rapporteur on torture, who had spoken about this several times in the, you know, after 2005, but made a very definitive statement, not only about his thinking that prolonged solitary confinement violates international law, but he specifically went on record to address the case of the Angola 3, and at the point that he made the statement, Herman Wallace was still alive, and of course Albert Woodfox was still in custody, and he specifically called out the fact that these two inmates represent a gross abuse of international treaties concerning torture. So what happened is we went from a national conversation during the first hearing to now an international conversation where you have an international audience now looking at us as a nation and considering us as very abusive in the way that we treat our inmates, as not being respectful of human rights practices that we've actually signed on to, and of us being very resistant to change when change is definitely well documented and needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In your paper, you give examples of what solitary confinement means. I just wonder if you can maybe sort of illustrate for our audience, so what does it mean? I mean, Robert King talked about sort of what it meant to be, you know, locked up for, 23 hours and maybe even more sometimes before one can actually, come out of the cell. Because, people might think, they might let people out regularly for showers at least, but that's not the case either. And what happens, when a person is, sort of sensory deprived for extended lengths of time like this?
Certainly. In terms of a definition and what it looks like, the name will be different in different states. So some people may actually go on record to call it solitary. Other people may call it closed cell restriction, which is what we do down here in Louisiana. Some states will call it segregation, some extended lockdown, special housing units, intensive management units. It doesn't matter what the nomenclature is. What does matter is when you have somebody 22 hours a day or more, isolated in a cell all alone, where they are not in any type of programming, they're not allowed to interact with other inmates, they're not allowed to interact with any other human being except the contact that they're required to have with guards. It doesn't matter what you call it. Once you have those conditions, you actually have solitary confinement. And that was one of the points of my statement, which is that the language differences in different jurisdictions has become an obstacle, because some jurisdictions, like the state of Louisiana, for example, will say, because we don't call it solitary, it doesn't exist here. And so one of my calls to the hearing committee is perhaps to consider codifying an actual definition, one that everybody understands and accepts, so that we can't play this linguistic ignorance, I guess would be a best way to term it. And so once you have an inmate in those conditions, that inmate is living in solitary, which means that they eat in their cells. They do not come out of their cells unless it is to shower, to use the phone, which they can do 2 to 3 times a week. But that also varies in different jurisdictions. That's the case here in Louisiana, but some states don't even allow that. Some states actually have metal doors on the front of the cell, so that inmate actually has no contact in the sense that they can't see other people, can't hear other people, can't even see daylight. Some cells don't have windows, and there are no restrictions here. Most of the cells are around 6x9. Some are a little smaller, some are a little larger. But ultimately what happens to a person is when they're submitted to these type of conditions, this is medically documented at this point that you will produce anxiety, depression, anger, cognitive disturbances, perceptual distortions, obsessive thoughts, psychosis, paranoia. And so what's going to happen is you take a person who perhaps was sane and submit them to a condition like this long enough, they have lost their mental faculties. And that is some of what emerged at the two hearings. Each hearing, there was a survivor of solitary to actually sit before the committee and testify as to not only what it was like for them, but what it was like experiencing the loss of other inmates around them. They describe seeing inmates, or hearing, inmates committing suicide. They describe inmates mutilating themselves. And both of these men, the one that testified in 2012, Anthony Graves, and then Damon Thibodeau, who testified in 2014, they were innocent. And so it leaves one to wonder, if you are innocent and you're exonerated, you've actually submitted an innocent person to these conditions, and then they're going to be released back into society with the expectation that they can integrate, which is a very difficult challenge. So this is the reality that was exposed through these hearings, and this is the first time in this country that we've really had a neutral forum for all players to come to the table and talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly. And unfortunately, there's more bad and ugly to have come out of this. But that's what's necessary for progress and change, and so that was a welcome thing. And the hope, of course, is that this is not an end, that this is not a formality, but that there is some meaningful change to come as a result of this. And I mentioned to you in my statement that Herman Wallace, who is no longer with us, he lost his battle to cancer back in October of 2013. But one of his final letters that he sent to me when he knew that he was dying and his treatment options were very limited, Herman wrote, and I'm quoting him, "I am a soldier. I'm a servant of the people, and if I am taken down anytime soon, my only wish is that the struggle does not end with me." And so that is what I am hoping to see. Herman's death, Herman, a man who died in solitary after 42 years, a man who was innocent at the time of his death. So a court had said that Herman really should have never been in solitary all those years. And when he was dying, instead of worrying about himself and his cancer and his treatment, Herman was concerned that my 42 years did not go in vain. And so it's sort of in the spirit that we have this conversation today to make sure that something meaningful comes out of these hearings that have been held very courageously by Senator Dick Durbin and the committee that he chairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you also mentioned, you know, in your concluding remarks in your paper about Martin Luther King Jr. And connecting what he said to what Herman Wallace says around the revolution. And people don't necessarily think about Dr. King as a revolutionary. And I like the quote you give there when Dr. King reflects on the 1963 Birmingham, Alabama Civil Rights Campaign. He says, "This revolution is genuine because it was born from the same womb that always gives birth to massive social upheavals, the womb of intolerable conditions and endurable situations." And just sort of referencing that, it is, you know, abhorrent. I can't even imagine what it might be like to be in prison, let alone in solitary confinement.
Yes, I agree. And I also think the quote was fitting because many times people think of Dr. King as someone who was universally supported, someone who all Black America believed in and cherished and valued and supported, but that was it's historically inaccurate. Dr. King was opposed by many African-American ministers and many African-American leaders, and at the time that he penned this letter from the Birmingham jail, the forces were telling him to stop. There were many people who said, this is enough, this is going too far, back down. And so this quote comes at a time where he is feeling that I am trying to push forward social change that is necessary, but I'm being met with great resistance, not only from the people who I predicted would resist me, but the people who should be in alignment with my ideology. And so oftentimes Herman would talk about revolution and how it was necessary to engineer social change. And so I think there is a parallel between what Robert King talked about, between what this solitary movement is about, and what Dr. King stood for. And I think that we're all pushing an idea that once upon a time maybe was not exactly attractive to the masses. But when you're a true revolutionary, you don't think in terms of what's immediate. You think in terms of the long distance run. And I think that that's what Dr. King taught us, and I think that's what Herman lived. And that, in fact, is Herman's legacy. He was not just a man who spent 42 years in solitary confinement. He wasn't a revolutionary as much as Dr. King was a revolutionary. And what Herman did was for other people as much as what Dr. King was for other people. Herman was offered plea agreements. Herman was offered plea agreements after he was diagnosed with cancer. He could have easily plead his way out. He could have implicated Albert Falsley, and he could have took the path of least resistance. But Herman stood because he knew there were many other inmates in line behind him. And so this was not about him. It never was. It never has been about Angola 3. This is about a larger movement for change that is so, so long overdue.
Wow. Yeah, I can hear the passion in your voice, Professor Bell. And I was wondering if you could maybe in your concluding remarks sort of tell us, our audience, sort of why you're so passionate about, you know, resisting these unjust uses of the judicial system. And what people can do to get involved around ending the use of solitary confinement on, you know, imprisoned persons. And I'm a prison abolitionist, so I don't know if you go that far, but yeah, just sort of how people can get on board and support, you know, the type of work that you document in this paper, and also where people might be able to read it.
Certainly. As far as why I'm so passionate, I'd like to sort of put this in context. I am a law professor, and it's sort of part of my obligation to engage in scholarship and studies. And so my involvement with Angola 3 started as a research project. It was just concerns about what the Constitution meant when you put a person behind bars. I was curious as to what the Due Process Clause might mean when a person is in solitary confinement, and so I just wanted to study that one legal issue. But after studying that one legal issue, I realized because of Herman Wallace, Robert King, and Albert Woodfox being so resistant and so determined, they had filed and documented so much litigation from the 70s and to the point that I got involved in this in the 2000s, that the paper trail was so compelling that it's difficult for a person to read the case history and not realize not only is there a human right violation, not only are there constitutional violations, not only has there been prosecutorial misconduct, but a grave wrong has taken place, not just in the lives of these three men, but all across the nation. We have a system of abuse that has developed, and if no one speaks on this, this continues. So this started as a research project, but soon grew into friendships with Angola 3 members, King, Woodfox, and Herman Wallace. And through many visits and conversations, I have been charged to act because I am not just a lawyer who has an obligation and an oath to pursue justice, but I'm also a Christian person, and I realize through scriptures that we do no good as Christians if we don't walk and do the work that we were actually called to do. Christ didn't sit behind a desk. He was out amongst people trying to do miracles and affect change. And so I'm called from that perspective. I'm called as a taxpayer because my income is being used to pay the cost of abusing human beings in the state of Louisiana, as is the case all over the nation. And I'm called to act because I honor Constitution and international law, which tells me that this is wrong. And so if other people feel so called, there are many things that they can do. The first of which is to be present in court when there are hearings, if that is in fact possible. The second thing is to immediately go to the Amnesty USA's website or to the Angola 3 News website. You will find the latest campaign, which is so compelling, because not only does it talk about the facts of the case and why the Angola 3 were innocent men, and not only does it talk about the wrongs involving the way they've been housed, but it talks now to the victim's wife, who has for years said that she has been a supporter, but this is a very public announcement of her commenting on the lack of evidence in the case. So this is the latest initiative, and it is extremely important that signatures be attached to this. So people can go to the Amnesty USA's website or to the Angola 3 News website and access that petition and not only sign it, but circulate it through social media, through Twitter, through speaking opportunities, through classrooms, on your job, wherever you are able to let people know not only about the Angola 3 case, but about the larger issues, because this case really is going to represent a problem being solved all around the nation. People can certainly offer prayer, not just for Mr. Woodfox, who is still in custody, but for all of us who work behind the scenes on this case. There are four good documentaries about the case that people can show in their local communities, and they can be accessed as well through the Angola 3 News website. People can use social media constructively by teaching other people through social media about the Angola 3 or about the larger issues involving solitary confinement. And one of the most helpful things is just a simple mention of support to Albert Woodfox, who is now 68 years old, who has now lived in solitary confinement for 42 years, who has lost his mother, sister, many other family members over the years, who has never been able to attend any of those funerals, who's never been able to have a family, and who three courts so far has said should not be in custody, period, because he is innocent of the crime that put him there. So if people would like to, they could directly write to him, and I'm going to give an address. He's at David Wade Correctional Center. His DOC number is 72148. The address is Bell Hill Road, and it's in Homer, H-O-M-E-R, Louisiana, 71040. And of course, people can speak with any of their legislators on a local level, Senator Dick Durbin on the federal level, Senator Richmond on the federal level. They can call directly to the Louisiana Department of Corrections and speak with Secretary LeBlanc, Governor Jindal in Louisiana, or Buddy Caldwell, the Attorney General, and let them know that you are mindful of the human rights, constitutional violations, and many other violations that are taking place in the state of Louisiana at this time.
Wow, that is, wow, this is just so, it's always great to speak with you. It's just, you're just such a wealth of information, yet you make it really, you know, the way you put it, it makes it easy to understand sort of what the course of action should be, you know, for
well,
all
really
people conscious.
Well, I really appreciate this opportunity. I thank you so much for this. This is a cause very dear to my heart, and this is a cause on behalf of people who have no voice, many of these inmates have no one to make a call for them, no one to advocate for them. And so when I do this in the name of many others who have no voice. And the same is the case for Robert King and for all of the people who have written into Congress with statements back in 2012 and again in 2014, because we understand there is a voiceless population here. And so we act on behalf of many others who are in need of us at this time.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Angela A. Allen Bell, to talk to us about solitary confinement and your recent paper, looking at sort of, you know, what's happened 2 years after the solitary confinement won the human rights, fiscal, and public safety consequences hearing before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights, I guess chaired by the Honorable Dick Durbin, Tuesday, February 25th, 2014. And thank you so much for sending it to me. I really appreciate being on your email list.
Well, that's rare. Most people complain I send too many emails, but I'm glad to hear that it was well received. And thank you so much, not only for having me here, but for your commitment to social change. It has not gone unnoticed, and I greatly appreciate speaking with you and your audience today.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care.
You too, and thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Good morning, Esther Vicente. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Good morning to you, Wanda.
Good morning. Esther is joining us to talk about the Caribbean Basin Institute for Education and Culture. And they have a concert coming up tomorrow, tomorrow, in Alameda to raise funds for a project that they are instituting. So I'll let you talk a little bit about your organization, Esther, and then I'll read your bio, and then we can talk maybe a little bit about Cuba.
Great. Sure. Thank you. First, I'd like to say thank you very much for giving us this platform to promote our organization as well as to inform the public about the events that we plan to hold over the next year and coming years to support our mission. The Caribbean Basin Institute for Education and Culture intends to engage in educational seminars, public performances, and people-to-people exchanges in order to support the development of education and cultural understanding and appreciation of the Caribbean islands and its indigenous peoples. We intend to do that through a series of events such as the one that will be held on March 6th, that's Thursday of this week, from 6 to 9, at the Habana's Cuban Cuisine Restaurant in Alameda. We'll get started about 6 and go to 9, and you're going to hear some fantastic Cuban music and have a good time and learn a little bit about our organization.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just briefly touch on what our main goal is for this year. As a new nonprofit organization, which was established in June of 2012, our hope is to support a delegation of musicians here in the United States for a travel and performance at a jazz festival. It's actually the premier jazz festival held in Havana, Cuba each year, and it's called the Festival Internacional Jazz Plaza La Habana. And now what's wonderful about this is that this jazz plaza was established in 1978, as most of our jazz festivals. It started out as a small jazz festival held in Havana. It's now grown to a world-class jazz festival held each year in December. And there have been performances from greats such as Chucho Valdez, who is the president of the festival, Dizzy Gillespie performed there, Max Roach, Steve Coleman, Gonzalo Rubalcaba, Michael LeGrand, Dave Brubeck, Roy Hargrove. I mean, and the list goes on and on and on. Unfortunately, however, due to the unnormalized relations between the United States and the Republic of Cuba, our musicians in California, as well as the United States, really have been unable to perform at this great jazz festival, which is an international festival. They've been unable to perform for more than nearly 54 years. And our goal as an organization, again, to sponsor a musical group for the first performance of American artists in over 54 years. It's a major undertaking, and there are a lot of details. There are details that we have to work out with our the United States Treasury Office, Office of Foreign Assets Control, as well as other federal agencies to ensure that our musicians are visiting and performing under U.S. guidelines, laws, and regulations. Now, the basis of making this happen, again, goes back to the events, the fundraisers that we will be holding all year. We need to raise approximately $25,000, and that's a very, very conservative figure. In order to host our musicians to perform over there. And we're hoping that Thursday's event will be a kickoff to a start in achieving our fundraising goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we spoke yesterday, I hadn't been aware that even though this festival is, what did you say, 52 years old?
Well, the festival was established in 1978. Since the blockade and the sanctions against Cuba, no American performers have performed in 54 years, as we know. The blockade was established in 1960. And followed by policy in 60. So it has been 52 to 54 years since an American has officially, let me preface that by saying officially performed at festival.
And there are three of you who make up, I guess, the steering committee of this organization, yourself and David Hardiman and Avacha. And I was just reading your bio, and you seem like your expertise is in international trade, and relationships. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the whole thing around, like, how this organization came to be. You're a member of the Oakland Santiago de Cuba Sister City organization, and I know that organization because Santiago de Cuba and City of Oakland have the same birthday. And I remember when both Oakland and Santiago de Cuba made 150, we sent a contingent of artists and young people to Santiago de Cuba to help them celebrate the 150th anniversary year. And my daughter was one of those young people. She was in high school at that time, my younger daughter. And you're also a member of the World Affairs Council of Sacramento, where you received a certificate of appreciation, and member of the State of California World Trade Commission, where you've also received a certificate of appreciation, not to mention, you know, your scholastic and, you know, academic preparation for the work that you do presently in, you know, international relations and trade. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, as I mentioned, sort of how this organization came to be and why it's important?
It's certainly. You know, I've been fortunate in my career. I've worked for the state of California for nearly 30 years now, and as well as a couple of other governmental entities in California, municipalities. And it's interesting how our careers take us to where, I believe, to where we should be and ought to be. And I started working, it's interesting, I started working in government, frankly, after working for a number of lawyers in California, which I very much appreciate. The background and the research capabilities and so forth that I gained in terms of working as support to those lawyers. But it was there that I first understood that I had an interest in law, I had an interest in making a difference, and I had an interest in world affairs. I was hired after a highly contested race that I worked on, hired in the Senate, in the Senate Majority Leader's office. I worked there approximately 2.5 years, and then I moved over to the State Assembly and worked in the State Assembly's office under, I would say, probably my all-time favorite mentor, the Honorable Willie L. Brown, Jr., former Speaker of the Assembly. I credit the former Speaker with really identifying what my skill set was and placing me in the Assembly's Office of International and Domestic Relations, where we planned in cooperation with federal agencies and international agencies, educational programs for foreign dignitaries. This would be with USAID, USDA, the Department of State. And so trial by fire, I found myself shortly after being hired in that office basically alone to do the program myself. And I've always been a trial by fire kind of person and rose to the occasion, but more importantly, found my love, and that was working with people from all over the world, helping to develop policy for international trade by way of speaking with these foreign dignitaries and attending various meetings with them and with our California committees, legislative committees, and various business organizations. So that's where I first realized my interest. After that, I began to work for the California Technology Trade and Commerce Agency, where again, I was given a very short time frame to complete preparation for a trade exhibition that California was holding in Germany. This required, the purpose of our trade exhibition was to introduce technology companies to the export market. This was in the height of the dot-com era. And unfortunately, the person that was there before me left maybe 3 months before the exhibit. We had a number of vacancies and preparation for the construction of our exhibit and quite a bit of work to do. Needless to say, what I would say is that we ended up having a completely full exhibit of various technology, which, by the way, I should say now is probably old hat technology, but at the time was cutting-edge technology, and we had a fantastic time. And the companies that participated, I believe there were approximately 23 companies that participated, were quite successful and have been successful and grown in exporting their products. After working with the Trade and Commerce Agency, I was recruited to serve as the director of the Agricultural Export Program for the state of California. And our focus there was very similar. However, it focused on agricultural products and commodities and assisting California companies throughout California on developing export markets to sell their products to. We were responsible for ensuring that California specialty commodities were promoted, marketed, and displayed throughout the world. And we were quite successful in that as well. So, again, I've been extremely fortunate, and I have had jobs with the state of California that have challenged me as well as provided me with an opportunity to do some really great things and support the economic base and California businesses here in the state. After I left the Department of Food and Agriculture based on basically downsizing and so forth, I decided to establish my own company and with the focus on exporting products to the Caribbean. Unfortunately, however, with regard to the economy, which started, as we know, to downturn in 2002-2004, the exporting area kind of became somewhat stagnant. Companies were not so much willing to spend the money for that kind of exploratory. Those companies that were already exporting clearly continue, but enticing new companies to export products was a bit difficult. So my company remained dormant for several years. Now, recently, with the advent of new policy changes, as well as some thawing, if you will, of relations with Cuba, and my background, which I should mention, is I'm half Cuban, half American in terms of my ethnic background. And with the seemingly thawing of relations between the United States and Cuba, I looked at the possibility of how I might lend my experience and my interest to that area. And basically met up with, I've known Mr. Hardiman for many years, and met up with Mr. Hardiman and Avacha, who we all know and love, is a wonderful a percussionist, and talked with them about the concept of establishing an organization that would focus on people-to-people exchanges in order to expose Americans to the Cuban people, the people of the Caribbean islands, which are not limited to Cuba. We're talking Barbados, Jamaica, the Bahamas, the Cayman Islands, Grenada, Guyana, Haiti, and several others, Trinidad and Tobago, et cetera, ways in which we could expose Americans to the cultures of the Caribbean, because many of our lineage are coming from the African diaspora through the Caribbean. And I think in America, we have not been educated, and I would say even more so for the younger people, we've lost education of where our families came from and came through. And by exposing Americans to various Caribbean countries and the people of the Caribbean, utilizing music, seminars, conferences, exposing them to pieces of our culture, I think is tantamount to all that my experience with regard to trade, with regard to international relations. That's what I believe it led me to this point and to establishing the nonprofit organization. I would just add that it is our hope to not only support the development of musicians traveling to Cuba, to Jamaica, to the Cayman Islands for jazz festivals, but also to develop a means by which, through our partnerships with travel agencies, sanctioned travel agencies, to develop people-to-people exchanges for the average American to travel to these countries, to learn about their culture, to experience their culture, to open dialogue with people from other countries who, in essence, carry our history along with theirs.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'm sorry. I get really passionate.
Such a rich, rich story. Oh, my goodness. And I was just reading, with your import and export business, that you actually were able to send medical equipment to Cuba, which is really wonderful. I'm glad you gave us the background, because it was really I mean, now we know that, you know, there's a personal connection. You know, you're actually Cuban as well.
Yes. And American.
Well, of course, you're here. and I wanted to mention that we're speaking to you, Esther Vicente, because the Caribbean Basin Institute for Education and Culture is having a wonderful fundraiser and performance by the Alta Havana Trio at Havana's Cuban Restaurant, located in Alameda at 1518 Park Street. And the phone number there is 510-521-0130, and the concert is from 6 to 9. There's no cover charge. And the Alta Havana Trio, features Rafael Ramirez on congas, Marcus Lopez on bass and vocals, and Charles Barreda on keyboards. It sounds going to be really fantastic. So is the dance floor open? Can people move around?
I'm sorry, I'm excited. The dance floor will be open. And let me just add another incentive. For the first five people that attend, you will receive a $10 gift certificate, good for a food purchase and whether or not it's dine-in or take-out. So I just like to, and half-price mojito Mondays, I've been asked to mention that as well. But first five people, you'll get a $10 gift certificate.
Nice. That's That's a real nice incentive. And actually, yes, there's a website too, Habana Salsa Mita. That's cute. Habanasalameda. Cute.com. And before you take off, I wanted to, I told you I wanted to mention this because we're looking at long-term incarceration, and we have a victory here with regards to the Cuban Five, and then there were three on Friday, February 28th, I guess at 2:29 p.m. this was posted. Fernando Gonzalez was deported back to Cuba, who became the second member of the Cuban Five to be repatriated to his homeland when he arrived. At where he arrived at Havana's Jose Marti Airport on Friday. So that's wonderful. His prison term was cut from 19 to 15 years, and it was a long journey for him from a desert cell in Arizona to his release in Havana. And if you don't know anything about the Cuban Five, you should definitely visit thecuban5.org. A real miscarriage of justice. I mean, seriously. We have a lot of those stories here in America, unfortunately, and here's another one. But this is a victory that two of the men have been able to go back home, and now there's three more to go, and then they will all be back home. So, thecuban5.org. Were you raised here? I noticed that you went to Laney College.
I was raised in New York. But I've been in California and Oakland for many, many years, and so I certainly consider this almost my first home now, if not certainly my second home. I love the Bay Area, and I have to say that I'm so happy that we are living in this time, and particularly this time, as you've mentioned, Mr. Gonzalez, it is a wonderful, wonderful event to occur. And I just am grateful that of the recent actions that have come out of Washington, D.C. with regards to civil rights, with regards to protection of individuals' rights and freedoms. And so I had to say that because this is a departure from most recent years. And so I'm just grateful to be able to witness this.
Well, I'm really happy that we're able to have this conversation, Esther, because I met you a couple of years ago.
Yes.
And, yeah, when Mr. Hardiman, introduced you at his concert, and we said, oh, I got to have you on my show to talk about your organization. And here you are, we're doing it. You have this first fundraiser, and hopefully, you'll have many more that I can announce and share with folks. And we don't have any music, but next time we will. And you talked about how maybe we'll have you on again with Mr. Hardiman and Avacha, and you could all speak about sort of the goals and objectives of the organization, which primarily its mission is to encourage and advance education and cultural understanding of the Caribbean islands. And the Caribbean is big. There's more than Cuba and Haiti there. Maybe you know about Trinidad and Tobago, but people don't think about Haiti as being a part of, the Caribbean because Haiti, islands, they speak French instead of Spanish. You don't think about Panama, but then maybe you might think about, think about the canal. It's like, we think about, we think, God, there's so many countries. Guyana, there are a lot of countries, and they all have their unique personality. Mm-hmm. The Bahamas, people know the Bahamas, so they go there for vacation.
These countries are so rich in culture, and when you step into these countries and you see the architecture, and you understand that those buildings have been there for centuries. It boggles the mind. And you see a different type of culture, and you see a different, you know, a different makeup, if you will, of how these cultures run. It's a stark contrast, and it is an enriching, and particularly for people of color, it is enriching to go to a country and to see people of color running everything. And please don't get me wrong, you know, I'm not suggesting that we're doing anything wrong in that regard here, but as a woman of color, I don't want to get off on that conversation, but
you're
I will
on the
say
right
this,
show.
You know, there's something, yes, there's something to be said about stepping off a plane and looking around and seeing people that reflect you all around you, not one here, one there, one here, and one there, but everyone in the country reflects a part of you and reflects you. And there is something that is magnificently empowering about that and enlightening about it as well. And if you think, you know, you think about it further and you realize that the Caribbean, albeit large, is a rather small geographic area of the entire world. And one of the benefits of having worked in the international relations on the state level and with the foreign countries is the recognition that whether or not we understand and realize it, there are indigenous populations, people of color all over the world in places most people would not think. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's beyond the Caribbean, but the concentration in the Caribbean and the close proximity of the Caribbean to the United States provides an opportunity for us to get a different mindset, to expose a different culture, to understand that we as a people are able to run a country, to work with each other, and to produce a society that is cohesive and productive. And one thing I'll leave you with, and that is one of the statistics that has blown my mind forever about Cuba, is that Cuba has had a 98% literacy rate ever since I could imagine, ever since I started learning about my heritage. 98% literacy rate. That means everybody in the country reads. Cuba has a educational system where anyone and everyone that wants to go to college can go to college. You don't have to pay for college there. You get a primary, a secondary, and a post-secondary education as just part of their society. That's something, unfortunately, we've not been able to do here in the United States. So I'm getting off on that, but again, when you go to a country, when we go to a country and you see that we can, it really does. It's really something that we all should experience here in the United States. Can work together. We do have a society that is productive and can produce as people of color, and I think we need to recognize that, and we really need to work toward that and work toward working with our other brothers and sisters of color, because there's always strength in numbers, and whatever the differences that we may have, we need to figure out and find out how to mediate those so that we can move forward in the coming generations
so that our legacy will be one of power and strength going back to our heritage and our lineage. And so I thank you so very much for this opportunity to talk about our organization, the Caribbean Basin Institute for Education and Culture. And I hope everyone shows up, not just a few, but everyone shows up on Thursday evening after work.
All right. Yes, tomorrow.
Hello.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, so thank you so much, Esther, for joining us, and we'll definitely have you on again to talk more about your organization and your passion for, you know, sort of the repatriation of people of African descent, with people of color and indigenous peoples, you know, right here within our region, so that, you know, we can get to know each other and share in economic resources so that we can all be as wealthy as we should be, as opposed to being exploited, you know, from others, you know, with our resources. And you have a wonderful track record in this particular kind of work. So some good things are going to happen all the way around, culturally and economically.
Yes. Well, thank you so very much, Wanda.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been great talking to you.
Speaking with you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
So, bye. So we are going to be concluding our show with a very wonderful conversation with three of the cast members from Marcus Gardley's play, currently on stage at the Berklee Repertory Theater through March 23rd. The House That Will Not Stand, and we had on the air Harriet D. Foyt, who portrays, and, you know, I'm they're not with me to give me my voice quote lessons, so Makeda, and she also did the vocal arrangements and additional original compositions. Harriet actually has been working on this play with Marcus through its workshopping stage. So she, of all the cast, knows the play in all of its various incarnations. Lizanne Mitchell portrays Beatrice, and Beatrice is the matriarch in the story, and she's the mother of the three young women left fatherless at the beginning of the play, and trying to figure out sort of what some of their choices are with regards to, you know, what does a free black woman of their station, you know, sort of what various opportunities or avenues are open to them in this particular period, the late 19th century. And then Petronia Paley, she portrays two characters, and I am not going to kill the first one's name, but Marie Josephine is one of them, and it's just a really, really marvelous conversation. And I'm going to read to you what I wrote in my my review of the piece, and then we'll jump right into the interview, which goes for about 50 minutes, so we're going to actually go a little bit over, but certainly worth your listening. Freedom is on black folks' minds throughout the Western diaspora. Locally, Oakland-born, nationally acclaimed playwright Marcus Gardley's returns with another episode in the Black Diaspora Saga. And I want to mention that, you know, we've been talking about the Caribbean. And New Orleans, where this play takes place, is actually seen as a part of the Caribbean, particularly around its close connection with Haiti or Haiti. You know, the people in New Orleans, you know, sort of taking encouragement from the successful revolution and overthrow of the French, led by Napoleon, by the generals in New Orleans, in Haiti. There was definitely, you know, sort of a going back and forth with of information and culture between the two ports. So anyway, back to what I wrote. Marcus Garley takes us to New Orleans not long after the Louisiana Purchase and the impact of this economic move on the politics of a household where Madame Beatrice, actress Lazan Mitchell, free woman of color, holds court to her master's house, Lazare, actor Ray Reinhardt, whom we meet when we enter the parlor, I mean theater. Did I say free? Well, freedom is a product that one constantly has to negotiate the terms in 1836. The terms were often bondage, a kind of sexual servitude with perks like inheritance or a benefits package prearranged. Called place, these common law marriages were recognized as legal agreements under French law. However, when Thomas Jefferson purchased Louisiana at sale price, the deal connected to France's need to liquidate, France losing its war against enslaved Africans in Haiti, under the leadership of Generals Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Toussaint Louverture, Henri Christophe, and Alexandre Sables-Pichon. Thereafter, the law changed, and with it, the power wielded by African-American women with such status, free women of color. Elegant Madame Beatrice wants her three beautiful daughters to be free. This idea is contested by her master, who does not agree. Neither do her daughters, who only know servitude, the type they have been reared to accept. They don't understand that they are really as much enslaved as Makeda, portrayed by Harriet D. Foy, who is working steadily towards a day when she will be free. A colorful and delightful character, she is about as focused as Madame and will not let anything or anyone, dead or alive, keep her from her goal. In The House That Will Not Stand, this family of free women is juxtaposed against that of an enslaved woman. And Madame Beatrice's sister, Marie-Josephine, actress Petronia, who is kept locked up because she keeps trying to escape to go to Congo Square to dance to the rhythms of a blue-black drummer who has won her heart. When we meet her, which she lost as a young girl. Standing with a foot on both sides of the crossroads, Makeda loves the girls whom she helped raise and their mother, whose plight she understands. The House That Will Not Stand is a metaphor, as are many elements in this play, which is beautiful to the eyes, costume, set, as it is on the ears, original music, to the story, which is not neatly packaged at the end, and keeps one wondering. Skin color is as much an issue in this household as it is today. The three girls are all different hues, Agnes and Maudlin, lighter complexion than her sister Odette, who doesn't notice this until she and her big sister become rivals. The three actresses, Janice Abbott-Pratt as Odette, Flora de Liz Perez as Maudlin, and Tiffany Rochelle Stewart as Agnes, whose portraits hang in the living room wall, on the living room wall before we see the actual visions of loveliness approach from church with their mother singing, bring the reality of the impossible situation to us as they wrestle first with their father's death, then with their mother's unreasonable idea that they not go to the ball where eligible white men make bids on suitable black girls. Directed by Patricia McGregor, one wonders what kind of world exists where slavery is preferred over freedom, where love is the first casualty when offered little choice for happiness. Bitterness fills the mouth of Beatrice, who tries unsuccessfully to manage with dignity the fate of her girls. It litters the floor, falls from the magnolia tree, falls from the sky. What kind of world exists where one assumes bondage is preferable to freedom? Caught, must Beatrice's girls surrender, or are there unexplored options? I had a great interview, as I mentioned, with the elder women in the cast. So here we are with this interview with Harriet D. Foy, Lizanne Michelle, and Petronia Paley in Berkeley Rep's production of Marcus Garley's The House That Will Not Stand, on the Thrust stage through March 23rd this year.
Sorry. I got it. There you go. Okay, Wanda, anytime you're ready.
Okay, excellent. Excellent, super. Perhaps we could go around and you could maybe introduce yourself and let our audience know what character you play in the what role you play in the play, The House That Will Not Stand. And then I can ask you my first question.
Okay. Hi, I'm Harriet D. Foy, and I play Makita.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Lizanne Mitchell, and I play Beatrice. She's the matriarch of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Bonjour, I'm Petronia Paley, and I have dual duty. I do Marie-Josephine and Veuve.
Right. Oh, my goodness. I've been wanting to speak to you so long. I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to ask them? We're just going to just sit there and bask in the silence.
Doesn't work on the radio.
No, it's true. Oh, my goodness. I just love the piece. After it was over, I couldn't move. I just had to sit there for a minute, not more. Well, until they told me I had to leave.
Thank you.
Oh, my gosh. Harriet, your character, she sort of weaves everything together so wonderfully, and she's just so full of surprises. Oh, my goodness. I mean, I noticed the leke, for Eshu or Legba, but I didn't know exactly what you were going to do with that. It's like, oh, my gosh. That was like,
yeah,
awesome.
That's actually a new element to this script. I've been working on it since 2011, and that just came in this last incarnation since we've been here at Berkeley. And Marcus had thought about it, but he wasn't quite ready to receive it and put it in. So once we got here, he said, okay, I'm going to put it in. Let's see how this works. And I was adamant about us being honoring Legba and being very specific about his symbol and all of the things that we needed so that we wouldn't have any trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Lizanne, how do you pronounce your character? I was totally pronouncing it wrong. How do you pronounce her name?
Beatrice.
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 You are so beautiful. Oh, my God. When you put on your gold crown.
God bless you, Wanda.
Oh, my goodness. You got these lovely daughters, and they are so lovely. I mean, you just have, within the women, you know, your daughters, there are so many different personalities, and yet they could be one person, just many faceted.
That's exactly how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they're all extensions of me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then as we, you know, as the story unfolds, there's so much mystery around your character. I mean, you have such a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lot of secrets going on. And you had to be very secretive in order to protect yourself and in order to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's such a shrewd, businesswoman, manipulator. I mean, she's always thinking.
Yeah, she gets a lot of help from Makita.
I think all of the women are in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be during that time period to make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makita is a really good partner for Beatrice. And then your character, Petronia, both of them.
Characters.
Yeah. So is one of them the famous voodoo priestess?
No.
Okay.
Perhaps he drew some inspiration. I would think probably more Makita may feed more into that than the characters I play.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think so. No, it never occurred to me.
Oh, okay.
Marie Laveau, is it?
Yeah. I just thought I read something in one of the notes about Marie Laveau.
Well, that was an original thing he wanted Makita to play. It was a second character for the actor who plays Makita, and then he decided to release that. And that's why he brought the elements of the voodoo in.
Okay. Yeah. And Makita, you're an African. Was she a pharaoh? I'm trying to think. Or was she a queen?
No, she was a queen.
Okay, she was a queen. Yeah.
Likened to the Queen of Sheba.
Right. So let's talk about the story. You know, when it starts, I just loved it when I walked in and there was a body laying in state, I'm like, I'm in the right place. I love this. Oh, I'm from New Orleans. I just
not
love
anything now.
Oh, I can't tell them that they're gonna walk into a set. Is that new news? I mean, I already saw.
No, that's okay. That part, but there's other when we get later.
No, I won't. But
that's
thought
what Marcus wanted. He wanted when people come in to go, wait a minute, what's going on? Is that a body for real?
Yeah, and you do think, is that a real body or is that just a mannequin, and it's a real body. I'm like, wow, there's a dead body
on
stage.
I think that in the research, we discovered that during those times, people used to funeralize their relatives in the home.
Mm-hmm.
People weren't taken out to a funeral home or anything like that. So it's unusual now, but back then, that's the way things were done.
But, you know, my grandfather, this is Petronia, was an undertaker.
Mm-hmm.
And even in my lifetime, living in the South, the body was brought to the home.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so far from our past that you would have people come to the home and the wake was performed in the home, and a body would be. It's probably a carryover from that time, actually.
Mm.
And the fact that Keita's like an undertaker as well because she prepares the body.
Mm.
She does everything. She cooks,
cooks the food. Yeah. Makita is just like, you're just a wealth. I mean, I don't know what the family would have done without you, literally.
Probably speaks to what slaves had to do and what people in service had to do then and still have to do. They took care of things. They ran the household.
Yeah, real interesting, the whole notion of the title of the work, The House That Will Not Stand, which we don't understand. Oh, that's so redundant. We don't understand it until we've seen the end of the piece. I was like, wow, Marcus, you are brilliant.
Yeah.
And then we think about house as metaphor. We think of house as shelter. We think of house as prison. And then when we come into the work, it's after the Louisiana Purchase. So things are changing legislatively for the people that were once French citizens and now they're citizens of the Confederacy, I believe. Yeah?
Union. United States.
It's the United States then. Okay, right. Yeah, that's Jefferson. Right, exactly. But then, what does that mean, right? So I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the dilemma that Beatrice has. She's got these three beautiful daughters. She's got a dead mate, and the whole idea of freedom, sort of runs through the theme of freedom and what that means runs through the entire piece. And then Petronia, your character, Beatrice's sister, she is really mysterious and quite lovable. I really like her.
Thank you. I like her too. I think of her as a beautiful butterfly who got trapped in a cocoon of not being able to love in a way that would have been beneficial to her, because she was of a certain a free woman of color who could not love the kind of man, a black African kind of a man, and so the consequences of that have brought her to the condition she's in right now, which is trapped in her sister's home.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Lizanne, okay. Why don't you tell us about
silence? I didn't know we'd lost you.
Oh, no, of course not. So Lizanne, tell us about the situation that Beatrice, who is, falls into the purposes, a widow now with three single daughters that are black and free, and there are no men of color that are worthy, in quotation marks, of them. So there is this tradition that you are trying to break, that you are a part of. People don't think about free women being sold, to a highest bidder in this tradition. Why don't you could tell us about that tradition?
Well, the tradition is called plissage. And it is such that very light-skinned women, women who were called quadruple. Well, they had a breakdown of color that is just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And the more white blood you had, the more desirable you were. And but it's not only that this is a system under Plessage, but also during this time there were free people of color who were extraordinarily wealthy that had nothing to do with Plessage. So it's like almost like that period right after Reconstruction, there was this little window where people experienced a level of freedom, a level of wealth that was unprecedented. But it was a fleeting moment, because once these people, once white people, Caucasian people, or rich people who were in power realized what was going on, these laws began to be enacted that gradually took away their freedom. Now, when you see us with our hair wrapped outside of the house, that was a law. The women of free women of color's hair was considered so luxurious and so magnificent and so tempting to white men that they were required to cover their heads when they were outside. I must say that they were a huge threat to white women, because it was an accepted thing for a wealthy white man to have a quadroon, a mistress of color. And this was a more than likely a free person of color. There's a whole legacy going on of this kind of circumstance. But Beatrice realizes over the past 18 years, as is stated in the play, these laws began to be enacted that curtailed their freedom more and more and more and more. She does not want her daughters to have to endure the prospect of being enslaved. I think that's what is most prominent in her mind. And the only way she sees for them out is to escape to France. And the only way she can do that is through the money that is to be gotten from the man whose place she was. Mm-hmm. Is that too complicated?
Well, no, I saw the play. I don't know if but the audience mm-hmm. is going to see the play too. But no, I think that's very, very clear.
This whole system of Plessage is something that is not well known here in the United States. We're surprised at how many people didn't have any knowledge of this going on. But also, more importantly for me, this whole breakdown of color and how we treat each other based on color within our own race mm-hmm. certainly has its roots in this system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then within the family, you know, your daughters are a various shades of a brown, you know, to white, and then to look at that dynamic between the girls, between the sisters, is really mm-hmm. interesting, and sort of the power or the privilege that comes with, you know, skin color, which is still yeah. playing out today. You think, wow, this is so
absolutely,
old.
Absolutely. I think it's a huge subject, you know, there's a lot of anger, a lot of hurt, a lot of misunderstanding occurring,
mm-hmm.
and I think that it's a subject that needs to be aired out. Light needs to come onto the subject in order for us to move forward in truth and love. And I really appreciated that Marcus has opened this up in such a beautiful way for us to examine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, you all embody it, you know, really beautifully, because you are beautiful women. So that makes it attractive, not necessarily that the topic is not painful, but you're pretty. So it's like easy to enter it. It's easy to enter it, but then you think like, whoa, how heavy, you know, that all these girls had of value was their bodies. I mean, their minds were great. You know, some of them, some of your daughters are really brilliant, you know, in the play. But others...
But they, you know, like they are, one of the main things was
mm-hmm.
they were highly educated. They were tutored at home, and they, you know, they know languages,
mm-hmm.
they know history. They have the same kind of education that their white counterparts have, only it has to have happened at home.
Mm-hmm.
So they're ready to be presented in the world, and they're ready to handle the world to a certain extent, particularly in terms of education
mm-hmm.
and sophistication, too.
I think a very important thing that could easily be not thought of
was the aspect of female sexuality and how it was also informed by the system. We don't talk about it too much in the play, but it's underneath everything, because it was all about their sexuality too, their beauty, the sexuality, their ability to be entertaining sexual partners for these white men. And I think probably the only character that it sort of hinted at more would be LaVeuve, which is the other character I play, because she's referred to as a whore in the play. And I, in creating her background, have thought a great deal about her path in this society, which was not to be a place, but to be a madame, which of course they had also. But again, it's about black female sexuality too. It's a very large part of it, and I think that was one of the things that perhaps Beatrice did not want as well for her daughters, to be sexual slaves, which is what I'm sure those women had to endure. I mean, I'm sure they had to endure a lot of hardship. I mean, any woman who is in that kind of system is dealing with a kind of sexual bondage, which, of course, women are still dealing with.
Well, Makeda speaks to that in one of her passages, where she had to make, she had to be available to Albin, the headmaster, the head of the household. And as soon as she comes out, she says she used to have to do things to get him to get off of her. So not only was she running the house, but she had to be available to him sexually as well.
Mm-hmm. And as our playwright liked to say, and I'm not going to necessarily say one of his things that he likes to create a mystery inside of his work, which was a very interesting idea, which he doesn't necessarily tell the audience, but is implicit in the work. And so that is related to what Harriet just said, which I'm not going to reveal.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, yes, she too was his sexual partner in this house. Whether Beatrice knew that or not, I don't know. But certainly in one of the passages that my other character has to play, Marie-Josephine, she talks about the fact that she came home one day, and when she was a place of another man, she discovered that he was making love to her dearest friend at that time, which is my other character.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in the work, and it's an important part of the work, but he doesn't hit us over the head with it. But it's very definitely an undercurrent that I think people have to also address and think about, what we as black women have had to endure as sexual beings then and now.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then Beatrice, you know, just in her attitude, the way you play her, Lizanne, she, it's a business, because, you know, once she was in love with you know, the purse, her master, and, you know, she was betrayed. So it's not about love, you know, it's about making sure that this man is happy with you so that you can have, you know, some kind of inheritance, you can take care of your children. I mean, that she has daughters and he has none with his wife, that's a plus, you know, because he has an inheritance. So it's really interesting, you know, how much power, you know, the character Lazare, the man of the house, even though he's lying there dead when we come into the theater, you know, how much control he has over what's going on in the household and beyond the household as relates to, you know, his woman and his children.
Well, and also, you know, like, even though he left me everything,
mm-hmm.
I got nothing,
mm-hmm.
you know, because the United States law says that I don't, that the white woman that he was married to should be the inheritor of everything, even though he has said in his will that I am the one that is to receive everything. So, you know, you wonder where the power really lies.
Well, it speaks again to the power of white male supremacy, and even from the grave. I mean, he is dominant in that family because he is a white male.
But even as being a white male in a minority of giving the inheritance, giving all his goods to a black woman, he's still overruled by the majority of other white males who run.
Those are the laws of the land.
Yeah, those are the laws. And but these laws change at the whim of who is in power. So a law is not based on integrity or honesty. It's based on who is in power.
It's to serve the people who are in power, those
yeah.
laws. And they still do. They serve the people who are who have the power to change the laws and to implement them. And certainly that's what was happening at that time, that they had to control female sexuality. They had to control slaves. They controlled everything. And we're still dealing with that.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk about, I was just thinking about inheritance and how the economics of our place in this country have always been topical to date, you know, sort of spending, you know, hundreds of years enslaved, building up the capital for Western culture still means that for the majority of people of African descent in this country, we are still not, we don't have wealth to be able to pass on. We have some wealth, but we don't nearly have, you know, the Rockefeller or the other folks, you know, that kind of inheritance. So I just wonder if you could, so what was going on with the free black people in New Orleans, in Louisiana, to the point that, I mean, were they at these balls where the girls or women were introduced and bid on?
It's my understanding that there were only a certain a class of people, if that's the right word,
okay.
a type of woman. It would be those women who were desirable and who were in a position to attend those quadroon balls. I don't believe they would have been open to just anybody to go, and they were only for white men and women of a certain order. But it is also my understanding in the reading I've done that there were successful people of color, particularly women, because they really outnumbered the men at that time in that world. The lifespan was not that great, but the women, because of their position had being placés in these relationships, they were able to amass fortunes that other people could not.
In the beginning, they had to actually import women, and they called them
yes.
the casket
yeah.
Women, I believe, or casket girls.
Casket, yeah.
But they were bringing them in because it was there were a lack of women.
And they didn't want to come.
Exactly.
Because of disease, and mm-hmm. they didn't want to come there, so they didn't have white women. So they had to turn to the Indian women initially, I believe, and then, of course, they turned to the African slaves, and then they started to create this whole class of people, these women who were totally desirable. And the character, Lazar, in the play says he wants to seed his daughters so that they will produce beige children for men of his class. I mean, he says that. So that's, there you are.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, they were being bred in a way
but
to service these men.
There were also black, you know, free people of color who were black men, you know, who also had big land holdings, you know, and were very successful entrepreneurs. And I think that is the world that Beatrice grew up in. And so this change, you know, since she has become an adult, has been so drastic and scary for her, because there was this one time where free people of color actually were, you know, becoming so wealthy that, like I stated before, that they were considered to be a threat to the white moneyed establishment, and they were both men and women during that time.
And they also went to France, a great many of
yeah.
them, to be educated,
mm-hmm.
and were very accomplished people, as Lizanne is saying.
And the quadroons, the women who were at the balls, were on the same level educationally and in terms of sophistication as white women. They were extremely good conversationalists. They were very intellectual and very, very beautiful. And this deal that they had with these white men was negotiated by their mothers, who made sure that they were cared for in such a way that they wouldn't be just left out in the cold should the man decide to leave them, because, you know, it was not a marriage, so it's not binding, and these laws change all the time. So these monetary types of things had to be executed in such a way that they would be well provided for.
And we also discovered during that time that some of the white women passed as quadroons because the women of color were so successful. Mm-hmm. If they had that type of coloring, they would actually do that so that they could get some of that success and money and wealth and all that.
Wow, that's so interesting. And then the whole idea of respectability, you know, one thinks about sort of this whole idea of bartering and sale of one's daughters because of their external qualities, you know, their beauty and their poise and their education. But basically, they just want to just have sex with these women because, you know, that's ultimately their job. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's almost hypocritical, the whole setup of this transaction. And we think about, you know, now that, you know, we have this thing called, you know, sexual trafficking, which people talk about as, you know, modern slavery. And this is a particular type of trafficking that was, you know, part of society. It's really, it's really interesting because I hadn't known about it before I saw the play.
Understand, too, though, during the stipulation of the plaçage was that a poem would be bought for the plaçé, and she would be provided for, and oftentimes her mother would be provided for, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still trafficking. It's still the sale of sex.
Yeah.
But in terms of capitalism, at least it had some kind of teeth that...
Yeah.
It benefits a woman in some kind of way.
I read, and it was voluntary.
Yes.
In that sense, more so than now, where, you know, people...
I wonder, though, if it were so for the daughters. I mean, could they say, Mother,
yes,
I don't want to do it? I don't know. But I also read that in some instances, once that relationship ended, because it seems sometimes the men engaged in these relationships before they married, they were supposed to make their fortune and then at some point marry legally, and they would enter into these relationships with these women of color. But I have read that sometimes when they ended, that the women would be, if they were not provided for, could end up destitute, and some committed suicide. So it also has a very dark side, which would be interesting. I've become totally interested in this subject. I also write, and I don't know if I'd ever do more with it, but it certainly is interesting, and there's so much more. The thing that's really wonderful, and to Marcus's genius and credit, is the fact that he deals with a very interesting topic, but he does it with a great deal of humor, and then there's the pathos of it all. But there's also, and you know, we see that in the end of the play, but there's also another side to that that would be interesting to see as well, the darker side, all the other kinds of things. But the thing that's really great about our play is that there's so much humor in it, and people just enjoy the humor, and then at the end you get a wallop. And it's just beautifully crafted, and if I may say also, beautifully directed and beautifully acted by the actors who share the stage with me. And it's just a joy to do the play. And I think Berkeley Rep has done a lovely job in presenting, you know, they commissioned this work, and I really want to encourage people of color to come see it, because it's a part of our history. It's a part of American history, but certainly a part of African-American history that people need to come, and they will thoroughly enjoy it. It's a beautiful piece of work. Beautiful, beautiful.
Also, Wanda, you know, because of our appreciative audiences here, we've been extended to March 23rd.
Oh, no, yes. I didn't know that. Oh, that's awesome.
Tickets are available.
Oh.
Particularly the second week of March.
Second week of March.
Get your tickets now.
Okay. Oh, awesome. That is so great, because I know for some of the performances, you all actually come out and talk to the audience, right?
Well, we there have been docent discussions afterwards, you know, but we haven't really had a talk back. That's what we refer to yet. But some are scheduled.
Oh,
I really look
excellent.
Forward to talking to young people who come.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone who will come, because like it's a subject that I believe will open up so much more understanding about what it is to be human.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really do.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, sort of the, you know, internal life of these women. And at one point, Lizanne, your character, you know, speaks about the price. Like, you know, you have to value yourself in monetary terms. Like, okay, how much am I worth, or how much is she worth? How much can I get for her? And I'm like, wow. And then, so the reflection is, if you don't ask for enough for the person, that means that you don't like the person, don't respect the person, or mad at the person. It's like, wow, to be able, you know, to have to reduce yourself to, you know, to monetary terms, you know, is real painful, I'm sure.
It's painful, and you know, but a lot of times when we do these period pieces,
mm-hmm.
we are looking at them from the perspective of where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes hard to really understand that that was the reality of the times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly.
It's not so different now. We don't think of ourselves as in that way, but we still sell ourselves in our salaries. Unfortunately, we live in a world where we're valued by how much money we make. So, in a way, we have a long way to go as a human race. Let me just put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long way to go.
Yeah, I was wondering.
With a price tag on our heads.
Right. Yeah. You know, that people talk about, you know, sort of how, you know, everybody has their price, and that's a saying that's, and I think, you know, some things are not negotiable, but if everyone has a price, then that means that there's a belief that everything is negotiable. So that's something that comes up, you know, in the play, too, about...
Yes, it does. Nikita
mm-hmm.
says that, too. Early in the play, she says that she's a slave and that everything has a price.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, too, Wanda, that, you know, having never known any system other than capitalism,
mm-hmm.
that's how we think. Automatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, I was wondering if you all could talk about sort of the African presence in New Orleans. You know, we hear about, you know, in some of the scenes about the drumming and about the dance, and there's a character that your character, Petronia Marie, how do you pronounce her?
Josephine?
Yeah. I don't know how to do the French version of it. I want to say Josephine, but I know.
You can just call her Marie.
Marie Jo.
Yeah. I know she's attractive.
Well, she talks about Congo Square.
Yes.
And it seems that Congo Square was this area in New Orleans where the slaves could go to congregate. They had vendors there. They had drumming. It became an area where it seems a lot of people would go there because there was this tremendous mixture of all the different slaves who had been imported or brought at some point when they could no longer bring slaves from Africa. They brought them from the South. So you had the influence of Southern blacks coming there. You had the people who lived there. And it was this melting pot where people could gather and could talk their language. And the thing that the French...
And that was allowed. That was the only place that was allowed that they could do it.
You know, the Southern white people did not allow the drum, which is so integral to African culture, to a lot of cultures, actually. Everybody seems to have the drum. But particularly to African people. But there they could play the drum, and of course you communicate with the drum. So it was that place where they could be themselves. They could do their dances. They could talk to each other. They could, I guess, have a semblance of what it means to be free in Congo Square, which I understand is a part of Louis Armstrong Park that contains this. I'd love to go there and see it.
And I think this, too, is what Makita is trying to get Odette to see, to understand who she is and where she comes from so that she can accept herself as a beautiful woman who is of darker hue. To connect back to that history, to the past. These are all the things that have brought us through to get us to where we are now. So you need to know this so you can move on and grow and love yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just wondering, that is a really beautiful scene where Makeda, you know, sort of...
Makeda,
yeah. You know, sort
it
of...
It took us quite a bit. We had a...
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was saying that we had a dialect coach come in and work with us because we all want to say the words in different ways, and Marcus was very specific about how we pronounce these names, and so we still sometimes have to work on it and say them every day because, you know, you just hear it differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, yeah, like Makita, Albat, Beltrice.
It's
a work in progress.
Not Josephine, but Josephine.
Yeah,
you know.
Right.
Do you know Marcus was also, he has a degree in French.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh,
so
he does.
This is like,
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so this, you know, he knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And then there's also the overlay, I don't know, I stepped out from it, there's also the overlay of, you know, how people in Louisiana speak also, so it's mm-hmm. that combination that so richly interwoven in the language of the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that Creole culture, and then Makita.
Makita's is not an easy dialect.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy dialect to learn.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I want Harriet, to talk about your character and her motivations. I mean, she's a really introspective and quiet character, but she like has this real spirit connection, but so does Beatrice, and we don't know that. It's like, oh wow, she got it going on. I mean, we thought, you know, she's just I didn't know that she was as deep as she was until we see her unfold. And it's like, you
well,
know,
yeah,
she,
well, I think when she wakes up that morning and everything has gone on, how she realizes this is her chance to get out. This is finally coming to pass.
Mm-hmm.
She wants her freedom. She's been hustling. She's going to do whatever she has to do to get it. I mean, because she even says in one of her passages to Beatrice, you could do whatever you needed to do if you let your daughters go to that ball. So she's supportive of that because she believes, you know, everybody's in it to get what they need to get. You know, I've been a slave, so it's not like she doesn't see it as slavery. She sees it as a way, a means of success to get what she needs. So that's her underlying track.
Mm-hmm.
She loves this family. She's been here, but she wants her time as well. As she says, she's not getting any younger.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has so many different layers, which I'm still in developing Makita, which will probably take me this whole run and our run at Yale to really get to the real core of her, because I learn something new every day from listening to the other characters and how they react to me and what I'm hearing, because we hear it differently every day. But she's very complex. She's funny. It's a wonderful piece, a wonderful gift that Marcus has given me to play her.
I think it speaks to his gift as a playwright that he has written a character with such complexity, and not only in her character, but I think even in all of the
mm-hmm.
all of the characters. Also, I want to say something about New Orleans that was unlike the South and their slavery is the fact that she could buy her freedom. In the South, you weren't allowed to, a slave could not buy their own freedom. But here, because of the mixture there, the French and the Spanish influence, she is able to do so.
And we learned in our research there was a woman who was sort of like Makita, and she was able to buy her freedom because she had her little side business of selling coffee, and she became very successful that she was able to go to her master or whatever and say, hey, I want to buy this. And she became famous, and I think the coffee shop still exists to this day that she created.
Mm. Wow.
But to get back to Marcus, it bespeaks again to his artistry to create a character who appears one way at the beginning, and then we see her change and her evolution and her growth,
mm-hmm.
which is what a play should do. No character should be static. You should have some movement. There should be an arc to your journey during the course of the play. And we definitely see that in Makita's character.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and she's the connection to Africa, to the past.
I wish, Wanda, that maybe later on, if
mm-hmm.
you have time, to hear the voice of the young people in the play, because, I mean, they're coming from a very different perspective from us, and I
mm-hmm.
think that it also, you know, shows Marcus's genius to have all these generations
mm-hmm.
At the same time, and their voice connects other young people to this play and what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully, because they are three amazing young women.
Mm-hmm. Very intelligent and very talented.
Yeah, and also Albin. Now, that is a story. You have one older Caucasian man mm-hmm. surrounded by all these very powerful women of color. That's interesting, too. So hopefully, maybe this can be a series.
Yeah, I like that idea, Lizanne. That sounds fabulous. Yeah, I was just wanted you all to talk about, you know, sort of the African spirituality as it meets, you know, the new world, you know, this Western world spirituality, because, you know, we think about death in a different way after we leave this play. You know, just because we walk into the theater and this man is lying on the cooling board does not mean the same thing that we thought it meant. And because the characters actually, they interact with the spirit world. I mean, it's not static. It's not cut off. It's the people who are gone, they still live, you know, within the household, within, you know, in a tangible kind of way. And so if you could talk about that a little bit, because that's a really wonderful aspect of the work.
Well, that again, it's about the playwriting. He gives us, it's so rich, it's so textured, it's so layered with different things. You deal with spirituality, you deal with Christianity. He seems to, there's a strong Christian influence, that you have the influence of voodoo. And spirituality, the idea of what is death and the spirit world, he includes all of these things in his work. I think also the play has a lot of magical realism to it, to put a term on it. And some things perhaps can and don't happen in life, but that's the theater, as I said. You know, it's drama, it's comedy, it's magical, it's power, it's the power and the glory of it all. It's a beautiful thing. It's just a lovely thing.
Also, Wanda, you know, like when I think about what we were, the attempt to reduce people of color to two-thirds of a human being, and taking away language, taking away any desire to, or any effort to read, anything to broaden yourself, all of those were taken away from us. So what do you have left? You have spirituality. You have the power of God inside you. And to me, that is why we still are so strong in our belief in God. People of color, black people, African American people, because we know basically that is what brought us through, because we had nothing else.
And the music was so important for black people then and now, and a lot of that, our music started there, because you had this rich mixture of people from all these different parts of Africa, from Haiti, because black people from Haiti came there after the revolution there. So it was just a fertile ground for creativity and music. And these are the things, and of course there's a spirit within the music. And we have music in the play too. We have singing. He's brought so many elements into this work, which is, again, it makes it so very, very interesting and so layered. And
we communicated when we didn't have the words.
Exactly.
We couldn't use the words. You had to use
you
music.
You had to use music.
And the drumming.
And the coding mm-hmm. within the music, which is how we got over mm-hmm. the coding inside the music.
Right. Yeah. I was just thinking about, you know, how beautiful the work is. You know, the costumes, the set. You know, when you walk in, you know, they're paintings of the young women in the household, and it's like, wow, this is such a nice touch. and
beautiful
then fashion. Yeah, and then there's like upstairs, you know, in the house, and you know, a lot of the young people's their conversations away from mom are upstairs, and then there's downstairs in the back way to leave. It's very, very nice set, and you're right, the music is really
upstairs,
lovely.
Upstairs, downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Or Abington downstairs.
Well, they wanted you to feel like you were in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So it's such a wonderful space to have this piece take place in, because it lets you, we get to feel the audience, we get to feel you breathing, you get to feel us. It's
mm-hmm.
it's just a great connection.
And there, you know, like it has a cinematic type quality in that you just don't isolate with one person doing one thing and then the next time another person does another thing. Things are happening all. You see Makita coming in and out. You hear Marie Josephine singing in the background. So it's this wonderful, like, you know, collection, bouillabaisse, gumbo of activity.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and then you know, characters enter from the audience. You know, you see the it's really, really, and then leave from the stage, go out the door through the audience. Like, oh my goodness!
I really wish that the audiences could see these gowns even more closely because they are truly magnificently done.
Really
exquisite. But I'm gonna tell you one thing: wearing that corset is a whole different kind of discipline. Just how you breathe, how you move, the whole way that you are is changed with this corset underneath. It's something else. You should try it.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you had a corset under there. Oh,
yeah,
my.
Everybody.
Yeah, and there are corsets that, you know, our wonderful dressers have to lace us into every night.
Wow. So there's a constraint.
You know, when you have a corset, your body structure is different, and you hold yourself in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, going with the authenticity of the period, we wanted to bring that element into the play. Mm-hmm. You know, women wore them, and it makes you have a certain bearing when you have to wear a corset.
You have to breathe under the corset. You can't breathe normally how we take in air in our diaphragm. Mm-hmm. You have to learn how to breathe lower.
Wow. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So are you in pain?
No, I'm not. I love wearing the corset, actually.
Okay.
It makes me feel uplifted.
Hmm.
So I don't mind it at all.
It can be painful.
I would like to take it off. Doing some of my more physical stuff, but you know.
Oh, that's funny. I was wondering if you could talk.
You have to be mindful of what you eat when you go to dinner, though. You definitely have to be mindful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe you all have lost some weight during the run.
I have.
I would say
I have definitely lost some.
It's very vigorous physically, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean,
yeah.
You just don't have a moment to really sit. You're always preparing for the next moment, you know, which is wonderful to me because in this era of high technology and people's short attention spans, it's good to have things happening, popping up there on that stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering if each of you, if you haven't already said so, a favorite moment in the work, or a challenging moment, something you want to share with our audience.
It's hard to do that without giving away, you know, putting it into some kind of context. But I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
I'll say for Makita's making gumbo without splashing it all over the place because it's such a short amount of time. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge of having to play two roles is very interesting. I'm a Gemini, and I'm very changeable, and so that has been an interesting challenge, trying to find ways that distinguish them and to try to bring the truth and a sense of authenticity to their different voices has been a wonderful and a beast of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would say for me, it has given me the part where Beatrice talks about her love for her family and the way that unfolds and how that unfolds gives me a deeper understanding of what love is about. It's not just a romantic kind of love. There's so many different kinds of love, and everybody has their own special way of showing it.
Wow. Well, thank you all so much. It's been really, really lovely speaking to you about this work, and I'm so looking forward to coming back now that I don't have to rush and come see it really quickly. Maybe I'll be able to come back twice.
And
well, some people have.
It would be nice to meet you in person if you come. So let us know when you're coming so we can make sure to meet you.
We had a great bar. You know, we could have a little, you know.
Yeah.
Treat.
That would certainly work. Yeah, on me. I wanted to I teach at the College of Alameda, and I wanted to do a theater party for them. And so now it'll be a little easier to figure out how to do it.
Go ahead and make that happen as soon as possible because we are selling out.
Yeah, we were looking at like Sunday matinee. That might be easier for them to be able to fit into their schedules. I'm already a friend of mine. I already sent around the people should go, and so I think some friends of mine are going to be there.
Thank you.
Yeah, on the 12th or something like that. But yeah, and I was trying to figure out if I could come with them. So I might actually come. There are like a few community groups that I want. I want to bring some women who are formerly incarcerated because I think they would love the pieces. Yeah. And then my students and then some other friends. So yeah, I'm definitely letting people know that they've got to get there to see because it's such a different story and one that I didn't know, and many people don't. I mean, like some people who are from New Orleans and are a little older, they know about, you know, this practice.
Mm-hmm.
But
and we've met some of them since we've been here.
Okay, okay.
We have a connection to the Plus Five.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like
yeah.
It's one of the producers, Zandra, I think her name is McDuff, is from New Orleans and knew specifics about this whole story. She enlightened me.
Yeah, but you all are just such fine, you know, actors, and it's just such so rich and beautiful, you know, in your hands as you embody these characters. It's just it's just such a great story and such a great evening or afternoon of storytelling. On top of like real storytelling, like, you know, Makita, she tells stories too, but then Beatrice, she tells, I mean, everybody's telling stories on top of the overarching story, which is just
It's really a joy to come to work every night to do this piece. I mean, because you just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's really exciting. It's like you look forward to it. It's like, oh, it's almost showtime. Let's go, you know? And that's rare that you get that.
Yeah. So have all of the cast been working on this, you know, for 3 years or so? Do you all go back?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. Harriet. Only Harriet goes back. All the rest of us are relatively new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you're all, but the cast now is going to Yale after this?
Yes.
Okay, nice, excellent. Well, I know you have a performance tonight, so I'm not going to keep you, but I want to thank you again so much for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
Oh, that you're welcome. Pleasure. Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. So, once again, that was three of the members of the cast of the House That Will Not Stand currently on stage at Berklee Repertory Theater. And for tickets, you can visit berkleerep.org or you can call 510-647-2949. And there are lots of discounts. There is a 30 and younger discount. There is a discount for teens and for students and seniors. I believe 1 hour before the show at the box office, you can get tickets $10 off. And, so there are a lot of ways to make this work for you. And you definitely want to catch The House That Will Not Stand, Marcus Gardley's latest opus, which is really fantastic, and we really appreciate the actresses Harriet D. Foy, Lizon Mitchell, and Petronia Paley for joining us to talk about their roles in the play. A little follow-up with regards to a couple of our guests. Wanted to mention that when Robert King spoke about the conference he was at in Chicago, it was the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual convention, and that was February 14th through 17th. Where there was a plenary workshop, Solitary Confinement, Legal, Clinical, and Neurobiological Perspectives. And there was a there were a lot of renowned scholars, and it was organized by Michael J. Zygmunt and Jules Lobel at the University of Pittsburgh. And among the speakers was Huda Akil from the University of Michigan, and Mr. King spoke her assessment of the effect of solitary confinement on the brain. And her paper is called Stress, the Brain, and How the Environment Shapes Us. And so I wanted to give you that information. And you can actually, there was a press conference kind of plenary afterwards, and you can actually watch that online if you go to the website. Again, that's American Association for the Advancement of Science Annual Convention in Chicago, and that was February 14th through 17th last month. And then I wanted to mention Saul Landau, a wonderful filmmaker, whom I met in connection with the Cuban Five and a film that he was working on at that time, Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up? And that particular film was screened at a really wonderful event moderated by Danny Glover and featured music, and it was just really beautiful. And Saul Landau produced more than 40 films and TV programs, 14 books, and thousands of newspaper and magazine articles and reviews. He received an Emmy and a George Polk Award for Paul Jacobs and the Nuclear Gang, a film he directed with Jack Willis in 1980 about the cover-up of health hazards related to the 1950s atomic bomb testing. And besides the film Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up, which was screened at Brava for Women in Arts Theater, and in that particular film exposed the true story of the Cuban Five, Cuban nationals who had been political prisoners in the United States since 1998, a cause Saul dedicated much of his last years to. And so there was a salute to him last week, which I missed, unfortunately, but at Brava. But I'm sure you can still support his unfinished film to be completed, Cuba, Out of the Closet into the Rainbow, and that film is about Cuba's homosexual community and societal changes. So anyway, I wanted to mention that. And I think that might be it. So I'm going to go out with, I actually have Alicia, who is the representative for, I think the international representative for the Cuban Five, and she's been on our show lots of times. And I think the last time, I'm not sure if this was when I uploaded this particular song, but there is a song that she sent me called Como Te Key, and I want to play that. And then I think I might play one more piece. And then we'll sign off until another edition of Wanda's Picks will be on Friday, March 7th, the day before International Women's Day. 8 o'clock Pacific time to 10 a.m. or thereabouts Pacific time. We have a really wonderful lineup scheduled for you. So here is, Como Te Key.
Y la piel, si no soy tuyo. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer, con mis sombras y mis sueños. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer. No me niegues nunca un beso. Allá en Londo, y verás toda mi estrella, la que no se ve en el hombro. Mira el cielo, mira el surco, mira la flor, mira el trillo, mira el centro de mi alma, y si la ves verás el brillo. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer, con mis sombras y mis sueños. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer. No me niegues nunca un beso. Una canción siempre es buena para saber cómo andamos. Si es verdad que lo que canto es en verdad lo que sentimos. Si mi nombre se te antoja para alumbrar tu ventana, toma mi mano y mi alma y siémbralas en tu mañana. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer, con mis sombras y mis sueños. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer, no me niegues nunca un beso. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer, con mis sombras y mis sueños. Mira cómo te quiero, mujer, no me niegues nunca un beso.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Well, I wish that I knew how it would feel to be free. Well, I wish that I could break all of the chains that are holding me. Well, I wish that I could say all of the things that I should say.
Kim Nally, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. And, yeah, it's really wonderful. Wonderful one man and wonderful, wonderful rendition of that classic. Since we're talking about freedom this morning on Wanda's Picks, we're talking about our brothers and sisters who are locked down and buried behind these bars, and we have to keep on lifting their names and advocating and working on their behalf so that they will actually be free. And we were speaking specifically about, you know, the case of the Angola 3